And good afternoon. It is a Thursday, May the 3rd, 2018. 14 minutes coming up on 15 minutes past the hour. Scott Spears along with you for hour number two of the Now program. Now, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping here before we get to our guest this hour, and it's going to be a fun hour, so don't go anywhere. I want to thank the legendary actress Pat Carroll, Emmy and Grammy award-winning actress Pat Carroll, one of our regulars around here, probably best known as the voice of Ursula in Disney's The Little Mermaid, but you might remember her from TV series like Too Close for Comfort and Sid Caesar. Wonderful Pat Carroll, who will be celebrating her 91st birthday on Saturday, Cinco de Mayo. So we thank Pat for being on last hour. And we also thank Rich Cordray, front runner in the Democratic primary for governor of Ohio, for granting us an exclusive interview last night that we will play early next week. 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow, will be on with us on Monday at 1:10, day before the primary, and Rich Cordray will join us again on primary day at 12:10 live. So a lot of stuff coming up here in the next week. And tomorrow, I can't announce it yet because I'm not sure if it's going to happen or not, but stay tuned to this station tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. We might have something big. So I can't even tell the other people around here, because if it doesn't happen, then I'll look really bad. But stay tuned tomorrow. But this hour is going to be a lot of fun because it's an interesting story. And it's the son of a man who a lot of people admire for so many reasons, the late, great Elvis Presley. There'll be some music this hour, some story, and certainly a lot of interest, I'm sure, as we are joined on the telephone by a gentleman who professes to be the legitimate son of Elvis Presley, Elvis Aaron Presley Jr. Elvis, how are you?
Fine, thank you, sir. I'm doing really good. I've been traveling a lot and doing shows all over the country and so forth.
You know, in the introduction there, I have to say professes because there is some doubt. How do you describe the situation you have with your father?
Well, absolutely, there's doubt. There's also skepticism and so forth. I've been dealing with that for over 40 years. It's nothing new to me. And, you know, I'm glad to have that because that is basically an interest in my shows and my music all over the world. One of the things I must say is that a lot of people don't know about me is because I've never had a hit record. I've recorded 39 albums, started off in 45s and vinyl and so forth way, way back. And, you know, just because of that situation, they don't hear of me every day. So that is probably one of the reasons. But I've been doing concerts, shows, all kinds of events, and so forth for 40 years. I've been traveling and doing a lot of great venues and so forth. And people can see my track record if they want to go and research me on. They can see my website, which is www.ElvisAaronPresleyJr. That's Aaron with two A's. And .com, and they can see videos and shows, interviews from all over the world, and so forth. And I travel a lot.
Now, you recorded some of your father's songs. How were you able to do that? Is anybody just have access to those?
Well, not really. I mean, you have to get permission to record them. And, you know, you get permission through the songwriters, you get permission through different companies. A lot of companies that have released my music, get the permission and make the CD albums and sell them and so forth. So, there is a track record of stuff like that as well.
So if we play a couple songs today, nobody will be out for our heads?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Okay.
No.
And we'll get into a song here in just a second, but tell us the story. How did this happen? Because we don't hear about Elvis Presley's son.
Well, you know, it all started back in 1961. He had an affair with an actress and a showgirl, and she was also a movie extra. And she was 18 years old at the time. And she met him on the movie set of Blue Hawaii. She became a famous actress later on. Her name was Angelique Dolores Pettijohn. And as a movie extra, basically in his contracts and so forth, it said he couldn't associate with any of the actresses or date any of the actresses, but nothing said that they couldn't, you know, invite and have a party with the movie extras. And that's where it all happened. Before you knew it, she was pregnant, and she had told her manager, who was John Harris. John Harris also worked with Jane Mansfield and other great entertainers. And when he found out, he approached Hal Wallace. Hal Wallace was a movie producer of Blue Hawaii. And Hal Wallace immediately contacted Colonel Parker, who was Elvis Sr.'s manager. And the Colonel had ways to hush up before any publicity came out, and made sure. At that time, it was taboo to have a relationship, not be married, have a child born out of wedlock. It would have ruined his career. He just got out of the Army and the service, and you know, he had many contracts that were already signed for millions of dollars, including RCA Records releasing, you know, several more albums, one after another, and, you know, motion pictures. So that had to be hushed up immediately. Colonel Parker was a immigrant from Holland. He was a Dutch immigrant. And he was also an infant orphan to the circus when he was born. So he found out that the quickest way to eliminate this problem was to have this little child that was going to be born out of wedlock and given immediately to an adoption to a circus family, and that would eliminate all the processes of you know, the media and so forth. And that's what happened. I was adopted out to a beautiful circus couple on Ringling Brothers, and we're only supposed to be in the United States for about 2.5 years and then immigrate back to Europe, and that never happened. So I grew up in the circus business for a number of years. Later on, I became an exotic animal trainer. First of all, I was a clown in the circus at the age of 5 and worked my way up to cleaning the animals. Later became an animal handler and animal trainer. Worked with exotic cats for magic shows and TV commercials, motion pictures, such as Cat People with Natasha Kinski, Brooke Shields, Sahara, and many other great cameo appearances and so forth. Same time, I was starting to sing, and I did that for extra money. And as we progressed with singing in these honky-tonks and little places, I was discovered by a manager that took me under his wing. His name was Monty Cole. Monty Cole was 83 years old, and he was actually Amelia Earhart's manager. And from that step all the way up, he got me on the first casino in Las Vegas called the Silver Saddle, Jack Schofield's Silver Saddle. And I worked with Monty for a while until he passed away. And then we proceeded to find a new manager, and that was Bobby Morris, my father's musical conductor from 1969 to 1970 at the International Hotel in Las Vegas. And he also conducted for Barbara Streisand and Robert Goulet and many other greats. And he took me under his wing. He had a booking agency and put me in all the major hotels in Las Vegas, which I played seven days a week, you know, 24 different casinos off and on. And after Bobby didn't like to tour a lot outside of the country. Mr. Seymour Heller became my manager, who was Liberace's manager. He was Liberace's manager for 38 years and became my manager for 13 years. When Lee passed away, took me under his wing, and I would do all the major casinos, theaters, and showrooms that Liberace would have played in. And Seymour was with me, as I said, 13 years of his life. He was a great manager. We did a lot of overseas shows, major concerts, mega concerts across the world. And after he passed away, Jack Gordon stepped in a picture. He was LaToya Jackson's manager and husband. He was married to LaToya Jackson, Michael Jackson's sister.
This is interesting. When we go back to your birth, why did your mother, your birth mother, give you up for adoption?
Well, she had to. You know, at that very moment, knowing that this child was of Elvis, you just, you know, it would have blown the media away. I mean, they weren't really in love to get married. You know, this was a fling overnight. Today, born out of wedlock is not a big issue. It, you know, it doesn't strike anybody about anything like that. But years ago, it was very, very harsh, especially for a big star, you know, a superstar, an upcoming star with more motion pictures and stuff. And it would have ruined his career, you know.
Did you spend any time with your birth mother?
Never.
Never did.
I regret that. I had the opportunity to meet her many times and so forth. And she passed away back in the early 90s, and we never got together. I was probably fighting anger at the time. You know, I was a young man that you know, thought that you know, the world should have been a better place, and that you know, I shouldn't have been given up for adoption if she really cared about me, and all the stuff that a person will go through when you know, when they find out that you know, their parents, you know, why didn't they keep them? Why were you given away? And so, but later on with age, things change completely. You know, they take a 360 degree turn. And I must say that you know, I was angry about Elvis Sr. I was angry about the Colonel. You know, I was angry about everything. But later, you know, the picture came together. I mean, it was just a protection thing about Elvis Sr.'s life and his music. And I got to say that I've been a big part of it for saving his career. If this wasn't hushed up, his career would have just melted away. And since it was hushed up, you know, it was taken care of. So you got to look at light in a different way, and the way that the Lord guides you. And gives you things and the options of life, and that's what I do. I follow life in a very, very special way now. It was one of the biggest gifts in the world that was given to me, to be able to sing and entertain and so forth.
Your father at the time of the birth, Elvis Presley, did he know what was going on?
Absolutely.
And absolutely. He wasn't able to stop the Colonel from doing this?
Well, no. At the time, you know, everything was hushed up in a way to make things better for him and his career, and for her career as well, because her career blossomed as well after that issue. You know, she ended up doing another movie with him called Clambake. And, you know, if you ever watch that movie, you'll see her in that film playing opposite to Bill Bixby. And so the ice was broken with that cause, but it was never mentioned. It was a sworn affidavit and so forth that nothing would ever come out about this issue. And that, you know, they would go on their separate ways, and, you know, life would be very good. I would be taken care of. And that's the way it happened.
Did you ever get a chance to meet your father?
Yes, I did. I got to meet him in 1976, backstage of the Hilton Hotel, and that was through a backstage pass from Colonel Parker to three other musicians that played at the lounge. They were playing in the lounge. The Colonel passed by and loved their music and asked them if they wanted to come back you know, and meet the King. And they were given backstage passes, and they had an extra pass. They called me up, and they said, how would you like to meet the king of rock and roll? And I said, what are you talking about? And he says, well, we got backstage passes. Colonel Parker passed back over here and at the lounge area in the Hilton Hotel, heard us playing, and gave us backstage passes. And we have an extra pass. Would you like to meet him? I said, absolutely. And so I was there with my friends. We were backstage waiting for this, this event to meet him. And it was only about 7 or 8 minutes before he went on stage. And he came through the elevator shaft and walked through the corridor of the kitchen area that was connected to the backstage area. We saw him come out of the kitchen area, and he was very, very flamboyant. He looked great. He had his costumes on and everything. And he stopped. All of a sudden, there was a janitor scrubbing the floor in the corner, and he went over and talked to him. And we just, our jaws just dropped to the floor. We couldn't imagine or believe that he would stop and talk to somebody that was a janitor cleaning the floor on his knees and held a conversation with him for a few minutes. And then he came up to us, and as he did, he shook hands with each of us and, asked a couple of questions. We asked him, and, my turn came over, and he actually, I said that, he had a wonderful costume and a great voice and so forth, and he looked at me, and I told him, his jewelry looked great and so forth, and took off this ring and handed it to me. And Southern expression back then was, try it on, son. And I tried it on, it didn't fit. I gave it back to him, and he said, no, keep it, son. Looks good on you. He says, I'll be talking to you guys after the show. At the time, I told him I was also an entertainer at Circus Casino, working with the big cats. And when I said circus, his eyes lit up. And, he also knew that we were singers and so forth, and he wanted to talk to us, but we knew that the time never would come. He was sweating profoundly before he went on stage, and, he put on a great show. He was a great entertainer, and I got to say that, I'm not here to take his place. There's nobody in the world that can take his place. I don't care how good of a singer you are or what you look like in appearance and so forth. The king of rock and roll was the king of rock and roll. I just do his songs, I do his music, and I entertain the public. And that's all I do. But again, he was a legend, he was an icon. And my story's true. I've got a lot of great stories about my life, traveling all over the world, doing shows with many, many great entertainers and legends and so forth. And, my story's got over 200 celebrities that I've associated with through the years, and many, many great managers that I've worked with for many, many years.
At what point did you realize, being adopted by this circus family, that you were the son of these two people?
Well, I was told at the age of 21 that I was adopted, and that was for legal purposes. When I met Elvis Sr., I didn't know that he was my father. At the time, I was 16, going on 17 years of age, and it wasn't until I was 21 years old that I was told. And I had to decide. I had to make a decision. When I was told what happened and at the moment and so forth, I said to myself the first thing, will I be 40 years old someday and regret not facing the world and telling them about my story? Or should I just, go on with my life, which was great at the time as well? I was, being very successful and continue this lifestyle. But, I made up my mind, and I went with being Elvis Presley Jr. and took all the legal actions, all the legal ways and legalities and so forth to get through the channels. And it was a very, very tough situation. It wasn't easy. It was a very, very hard situation back then. But, you know, being able to work and present myself in the greatest light, you know, in Las Vegas, on all the big billboards and so forth in the casinos, and working with the great managers, that was a major part of my success right there.
Why did you decide to what was your birth name, and why did you change it to
my birth name was Philip Stanek, and I did decide to change it because of who I was. You know, you can't go on by a different name in show business and say, oh, I'm so-and-so. And by the way, Elvis was my father. You know, the first thing said, well, if Elvis was your father, you know, why didn't you change your name? You know, and to change your name legally for a superstar like that, that's not easy, especially, you know, in that limelight of all that controversy and of all the things that are going on, you know, and you know, the Elvis name is so big, it's so phenomenal, you know, it's so intriguing that everybody wants to know about it. And so by doing that took place and, you know, helped me with my career a bit. You could say it was both a burden, you know, and it was a curse, and it was also a great thing that people appreciated as well when they you know, got to see me.
Now, when you did this name change, of course your father is dead, your mother is dead, but Colonel Parker is still alive, the man who engineered this.
No, he's not.
Oh,
passed away as well.
It happened after 97.
Yeah, Colonel Parker passed away back in 97.
Yeah, so when did the name change take place?
Oh, the name change came place back in 83.
So the name change had taken place.
Absolutely.
So yes. Before...
And I got to meet the colonel later in life as well.
And what did he say?
You know, the colonel was protecting his image. At the very beginning, the colonel didn't want to speak to me. And it was because of Seymour Heller, my manager that managed Liberace. They were very good friends. And they would rotate their big stars at different casinos quite a bit and so forth. And also, you know, share the same auditoriums and theaters on the road and all of that. So it was Seymour Heller that got me introduced to the colonel. And after the colonel had met me, we became friends. And, you know, he explained a few things to me that were stuck in my mind. I realized that the colonel wasn't a bad person, as everybody had portrayed him. He was a shrewd businessman, and he made things happen. A lot of people disagree with that and say, oh, well, the colonel took 50% of his income. Well, he never did that. You know, the colonel was the first one to put money up to get all the motion pictures going, you know, and work with a lot of the people on getting his contracts and so forth, and getting the merchandising out. And if it wasn't for the colonel, there would be no Elvis. You know, and I say that very clearly, very proudly, because you know, I've got a new manager today now. You know, after going through so many different managers, most of them passing away and so forth. You know, I've recently hooked up with the right hand man of Colonel Parker that worked with the colonel. Also, had managed Ricky Nelson's career to the end, and then Roy Orbison's career, and is also working with me.
Were you angry when you met the colonel?
No, I wasn't angry. I was already now in a situation where I would look at the colonel and wonder why, and ask some questions. And he loved the circus himself, as he was an orphan infant of the circus, and thought that was the best upbringing. And probably the best way to, you know, get rid of this child of, you know, being a burden to the press. And we shared some stories together. We shared, you know, some interesting stories. I wish I had more time that I could have spent with the colonel, too, and so forth. But, you know, truly he was a nice person when you got to know him. When you didn't get to know him. You know, he was a businessman. He was a shrewd businessman. And that was it, you know.
What did he tell you that you didn't know?
Well, he told me a lot of stuff that I'm putting a book together, matter of fact. And we're, you know, I can't give you all the juice and potatoes in this interview. We got to save a lot of it for the book, which is an extreme story and also a documentary that we're trying to negotiate for right now. And because it's got so much content in it, it has to be done in a way that we could actually get all of my story out without losing parts of the interest. And there's so much interesting stuff in there, though.
Is there one bit you can tell us of something that he told you?
Well, you know, the hard thing about revealing certain things that he had said is basically that, you know, we have to put a lot of the stuff in the book. And that's a conversation and different conversations I've had. But I will reassure you one thing he said, you know, at the time. He says, you got a great manager working with you, and I'm proud to be associated, you know, through your manager, Seymour Heller, and which I've got a letter from him as well. And, you know, I've got cards from the colonel. I've got signed cards and letters and wishing me the greatest of success and so forth. A lot of this stuff has never been revealed, never been shown to the public, never been read by the media or anything like that. It's because we've, you know, I've been saving all this for the book. And there's a lot of letters from a lot of people that were very famous that worked with Elvis Sr., you know. Well, and I've worked with a lot of these people through the years.
In regard to your relationship with the colonel and your relationship with your father, Elvis, obviously there's some stuff here that, as you say, has never been said or heard before. What is the nature of it without telling us exactly what it is? Why have you held on to it? What nature is it that you, since 1980, have never done it?
Well, you know what? It didn't seem like it was interesting at the very point then. There was other parts that one had to work to survive and to, you know, to accomplish things on the road, traveling, musicians, you know, new band members. A lot goes into a show, and a lot of concentration goes into a show, especially when you're going overseas and so forth. And so a lot of this hasn't been focused on. There was a couple of deals that were supposed to come through that never came true. We had negotiated a deal back in 1993 with revealing my life story in a book format. And this was done between the managers that I had in the United States, the managers in England, and the managers in Canada. There was a triple management agreement here. And at the time, they had Gordon McGill as a writer out of England that wanted to write my book and my life story. Gordon McGill wrote The Omen 1 and The Omen 2, you know, striking books, which I found out later was interesting because one of the last books that Elvis Sr. had read when he was boarding his plane and he held it up in his hand was The Omen. And it was crazy that, you know, he liked stories like that. But they were negotiating to pay me £150,000 back then, which was $300,000 upfront money. And the management, you know, was greedy on the other two sides. They just wanted more money. And so the book never came through. You know, they wanted double that amount. And so, again, that's another thing. It's another story of going through different management, different people that I've worked with and associated with. Some great, great stories. Every manager has a great story that I've worked with.
You know, it's...
So, yeah, it is. And you know what? At the time, I didn't care about what was going on with my life. I found out later in the middle of my life, in the, you know, back in the 40s of my life, that this is a real life fairy tale. This is not a story that you can make up. Why? Because there's so much proof behind everything. every element, every contract, every concert, every show, every celebrity, you know, pictures, videos. So the fantasy of this thing is a true life fantasy that has come true.
Let me ask you two questions, because I think this is interesting. Now, I certainly understand, because this has happened before. It's happened with presidents. When you were born, the people who obviously knew about it were your mother, your father, and Colonel Parker, who did the arrangement.
Right.
By the time you knew in 1980, your father is dead and your mother will soon be dead. But Colonel Parker lives on to 97, 20 years after Elvis is gone, many years after your mother is gone. You meet with him. And there is skepticism, as I said in the beginning of this interview, skepticism to this day. Why did Colonel Parker never say, yes, it's true? That's all he would have had in any point in the 17 years.
Well, he would have. We were getting closer to getting this out with the Colonel. But the Colonel had his own ties and his own reasons. And... you know, those reasons are going to come out in the book later, of course. My associate partner and manager that has been the right-hand man of the Colonel for many, many years, grew up working with the Colonel and later, you know, managed some of the other greatest icons that ever lived. And he's got over 15,000 pieces of... literature and contracts and letters and telegrams and so forth about the Colonel that he's getting ready to release as well. He's working, matter of fact, he just signed a deal with releasing a new documentary on Elvis and the Colonel, you know, Colonel and Elvis, which is going to be worked on and released, you know, as soon as they accomplish the documentary. And many books and letters that will be published and so forth. So there's going to be more and more stuff coming out about me as well, you know, now that the vault of the Colonel is going to be opened with, you know, releasing a lot of different stories and books and so forth. There's a lot of things that people have totally forgotten the Colonel. It's only the Elvis fans that know about the Colonel. The normal public, you know, they really don't know much about his management or anything like that. So, again, this is another great, great story and stories that will be coming out about him and about his ways and everything. So,
let me ask this. 38 years now since you changed your name and you realized who your mother and father were. And there is, like I say, to this day, 38 years later, still some skepticism. Is there something in this book that will totally end the skepticism?
Well, yeah, there's a lot, but skepticism will not end for somebody that doesn't want to believe or doesn't want to read the book. Or doesn't care. You know, you got to look at this situation is that Elvis Sr. Was the icon. He was the king. And in a lot of people's eyes, he will always be the king, no matter what. No matter what went on. You know, in their eyes, he was a saint. And he was an angel. You know, it's only so many of so many people that realize and, you know, are educated to want to learn more and know more about him and his life and myself. And we're educating the public every day about things. And whenever I do a concert or a show, you know, there will be people that come to my show that have heard about me, of course. And then there will be people that never heard about me. You know, and there's people on your radio show, listening to your radio show right now, that never heard about me. And again, that all comes out because, you know, my music hasn't been played constantly from all those years back. Now my music is being played all the time. You can listen to me on ElvisJRRadio.com. And this radio station plays in 186 countries all over the world.
We've got about 10 minutes left yet, and I want to do that. And I'm going to come back, and we're going to ask Elvis Jr. about Priscilla, Lisa Marie. What's the relationship there? But with the permission of Elvis Aaron Presley Jr., off of the album, The Story Unfolds, one of the all-time greats, Jailhouse Rock. Here we go.
When the critics ran out of things to say about Elvis's music, they turned to his movies. They stood in awe when they viewed Jailhouse Rock.
Walk to the party in the county jail. A prison man up there that began to wait. A prison man up jumping that began to swing. Should've knocked that jailbird thing, let her roll. Everybody let her roll. Saxophone, little old blown out a slide trombone. A drum for the knowledge and a crap boom bang. A whole rhythm changing and a purple gang. Let her roll. Everybody let her roll. Everybody in old Sam Block. Who's down to a jail of rock. Number 47, city number 3. A year to kid Tim, but ever did see. I sure whip a lot of what you call for me. Come on, new to jail, I'll ride with me. Let her roll. Everybody let her roll. Everybody in old Southern Blood. Put down to the jail, let her roll. Roll, 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 roll. South, south, sitting on a block of stone. Boom, whip, corner whip, and not alone. I won't say about it, don't you be no square. I can't find a partner, you're the wooden chair. Let her roll. Everybody let her roll. Everybody in old Sand Block. Went down to a jail, let her roll. Shift and set the bunny just for heaven's sake. I'm just looking chance just to make a break. A bunny turning shifty and a sand nick nicks. I won't dig around while I get my key. Let her roll. Everybody let her roll. Everybody in old Sand Block. Who's down to a jail, let her roll. Down to a jail, let her roll. Down to a jail, let her roll. Down to a jail, let her roll.
And again, that's Elvis Aaron Presley Jr. performing Jailhouse Rock. Elvis, Lisa Marie, Priscilla, this would be your stepsister. What's their stance on this whole thing?
Well, first of all, man, that song I recorded, it was a long, long time ago. That album, it just brought back some memory just listening to your play on it. Lisa and Priscilla and, you know, the rest of the family, they're great people. I've never had the opportunity to meet them or talk to them. It's always been a monetary situation to them for all of this. And one of the reasons is because, you know, you got to listen to your attorneys, what they've got to say in a lot of times and so forth. If they acknowledge me, my attorney had told me that if that was acknowledged by them, that they would be responsible on a lot of issues, a lot of monies that were divided and so forth. But see, I never cared about finances. That's one thing about it. I never cared about approaching the estate or wanting anything from the estate. I don't want anything from the estate. I'm the totally opposite. There has been other people that claim that they were children. I'm the only federally documented person. Nobody else is federally documented like me. But I have went over and claimed and wanted, you know, monies and so forth. And I look at that and I think it's a sad situation that this world has to be that way. I have been given a gift from God that has provided some of the greatest pleasures of being able to perform, being able to entertain, and I look at it this way. I'm the black sheep of the family. I've got my own estate. I've got my own reasons of things and so forth. And I just reassure you that they are still a wonderful bunch of people. You know, I know that Lisa has gone through a lot of turmoil and so forth. My door is always open to her. You know, I care about people, and yeah, would do anything if they needed anything in my behalf. But you know, we're separate. We're two different entities. And you know, the last will and testament of Elvis Sr., there's 13 pages. 3 pages out of 13 signify, and that he had more than one child, a brother and a sister. And you know, he knew about this last will. His father knew about the last will that drew it up for him. Charlie Hodge, his right-hand man, knew about it, spoken to me many times about stuff. You know, it was also signed by Ginger. It was also signed by the judge. And so the question about Elvis knowing if he had a son, yes, he did. It's in his last will. And that's one big part I'm giving to you on your radio station today. And I hope your listeners have appreciated this interview as much as I appreciate talking to him. And look forward again and being on your show some other time with some more interesting questions and even a show, maybe a show in your area.
Yeah,
one of my greatest representatives of your area is Jim Hiley. He has been a DJ for 37 years in Salina, has been a very close friend of mine for many years, has interviewed me up tons of times on his radio station. He also used to manage Orion, one of the greatest entertainers, Jimmy Ellis. And as I said, whenever I'm going through Ohio and so forth, Jim represents me in that area. And he certainly has a lot to tell the public and the world about me as well.
Elvis, we've got about 3 minutes left here, and I want to make sure we fill the time correctly here. What's interesting is that's fascinating that there was another will. Now, in that will, did he make provisions for you?
No, he didn't make provisions for me because you have to be able to attend the will, and there's a 7-year window in a will, last will and testament, in the state of Tennessee, Memphis at the time, back in that era. And, you know, I certainly didn't know that he was my father till I was 21. And when I did find out, I didn't have the money to be able to go and hire some of the big attorneys and so forth. But one of the biggest attorneys in Memphis has been my friend for many years, and had one of the biggest firms there in Memphis, as well as a museum. And that's the other thing. I've had several museums around the country for many years as well that people can go and see and attend. And we have one in Ohio as well that people could go to see. Part of my collection of my father is on display at Trader's World in Monroe, Ohio. And it's free to the public to go and see the collection. The cars, the memorabilia, you know, all the great greatnesses of Elvis Sr. And we also have a traveling unit that's in Florida right now called the Private Collection of the King on Tour.com. The Private Collection of the King on Tour. You'll be able to see that museum as well.
Elvis, because it's always a pleasure to have you on, because it's an interesting story, but when you are at concerts and, you know, people do ask the questions and there are people who doubt, when people ask that, when people, you know, think that this is a con for money, when people think that this is somebody who came from a circus family and there's a lot of illusion in the circus, that this is a great illusion, a great con to make money, what do you say to those people?
Absolutely not. The circus world is a whole different world too. You have to study the circus world. The circus world has been full of very, very hardworking people. The carnival world is a con world. The circus world is a hardworking world with gymnastics and trainers. Whether they're training the animals or training themselves in gymnastics to perform. and that is definitely not a con. And to be out for you know, the length of time that I have been, and doing the concerts and shows and worldwide interviews, even performing in Memphis, everywhere, you know, you can't do that. That you know, you have to be professional. You have to be real. And I am real. And my stories are real, and so forth. So when the people come out to see the show, they will see the reality of it, too. They won't see an impersonator. They'll see the reality of me being myself and telling bits of stories in my show. And truly, if somebody else would do something like this, they would be stopped immediately by the estate. That is really, really quick. You know, there's a lot of control by the estate on a lot of things right now. And even their, you know, their shows with their ETA artists, Elvis tribute artists, they don't call them impersonators anymore, and so forth. My era, way back, they would call them impersonators and impressionists. And but all that has changed. So, you know, seeing me, seeing my performance, and being myself, that's it.
Elvis Aaron Presley Jr., the son of Elvis Presley. It's always an interesting conversation, and I thank you for coming on. It's always a good time. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope we can do it again real soon, maybe in person, and maybe a concert up this way for all those Elvis Presley fans that I know are in the area.
Well, Scott, it's been a pleasure, and you're listening to Scott Spears on WWGH Radio.
Thank you. For this day, very interesting. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Wood, 101-year-old Norman Lloyd.
Now, did you like that, Norman, when that edict came down? Did you like driving?